you guys. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. Stand by a minute. Looks like we do have, with a delay, we have the Selden machine repeating the signal. A little bit noisy sounding though. The TechNet, as you guys know, we gather to discuss our favorite subject, our favorite hobby, AM radio, and wireless equipment in general. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. We take chickens during the first hour or so for people who do have a question or a comment for the net. And past nets, the whole 4 hours worth of them, because it starts at 8 and usually ends at midnight, you can listen to past recordings at amateurradio.tangovictor. That's the website, amateurradio.tangovictor. And there's another associated website, limarktechnet.com, which has other equipment, other articles and pictures associated with the TechNet. The second half of the TechNet is run by Dr. Roy, AC2GS, who gives us the mailbag and science talk. And we have reason to believe he'll be returning tonight after a slight illness. And then the third section is run by Paul, WS2N, who will be telling us an awful lot about what happens with National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the other worldwide space agencies of other countries. So do we have anybody with a question or comment tonight? Just give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW TechNet, we're listening.
N2Z Echo Alpha, name's Glenn. K2VDH, John, yes.
Okay, we got N2Z Echo Alpha, Glenn, and John, I think it's Delta Delta Hotel, but I missed the prefix. Give me your whole call letters, John.
Yeah, that's WA2 Victor David Henry. That's Willie Alpha 2 Victor David Henry.
Okay, Victor David Henry, Whiskey Alpha 2, we got you, John. So we got Glenn and John. Anyone else to check into the TechNet with a question or a comment, please give me your call letters, phonetically, hopefully, and name right now. K2RIW listening.
Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike, Rich, and yes.
Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike, Rich. And glad you gave us the whole works. Okay, Glenn, John, and Rich. Anyone else? Give me your call letters, phonetically, and name right now. K2RIW. More than enough to get going. Glenn, into Zebra Echo Alpha. Go right ahead with your question or comment. We're listening, Glenn.
Thank you, Dick. I have a vintage 1970s audio amplifier, and it died. And there are no TV repair shops around. I was wondering if there's anybody knows anybody who might be able to fix this amplifier. I do have the schematic.
Yeah, the only guy I know who is actively doing repair of electronic equipment, usually ham radio, but not necessarily. He's got the skill to repair lots of other pieces of electronics, is Andy, WA2CDL, Whiskey Alpha 2 Charlie. Let's see now, that's commercial driver's license, Charlie Delta Lima. So I wonder if you've ever heard Andy, WA2ZDL on Glenn. He comes on periodically, and if you get a hold of him and have a discussion, I think it's a good chance you'll get a favorable response. Back to you, Glenn, and to Zebra Echo Alpha, K2RIW.
Roger that. Is Andy the gentleman who at the ham fest who does the tune-ups?
The very same guy. He's the one. And by the way, I was about to ask you, what are the symptoms of your amplifier? Simple audio amplifier. I can't say. It doesn't have a display. Doesn't have video. I'm guessing you hear no sound, or you hear a loud hum sound that you don't like the sound of. So what are the symptoms of your failed amplifier? And is it a tube-type amplifier? Over to you, Glenn.
No, it's a vintage transistor. It has a protection circuit in it that would pull out a relay if the output was funky. And as time was going on, it would just turn itself off and then on, and then more frequently. And then I smell the horrible smell of burnt electronics, and it doesn't come out at all now.
It reminds me of what that joke that people say about motors. A motor will fail when somebody makes a mistake and lets the smoke out. Except the smoke is what makes it run. Okay, so let's hope that Andy will be able to help you. And he signs in sometimes, and so that both the TechNet, and you'll hear him on from time to time. But yes, you've seen him at the at each of the flea markets doing doing technical testing, doing checkups and calibrations. Next person was John, to B2VDH. Go right ahead, John, with your question or comment.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, I just wanted to say good evening to everybody on the net. Not really a question, just two fast comments, actually. First of all, I just wanted to recommend the January-February issue of QEX magazine. It has a whole article on the nano DNA that was discussed a few weeks back. They give a block diagram of the whole thing, and quite a good article, quite a good reading on the whole system. The person actually has the device, and he did a nice write-up on it. So I just wanted to mention that if anybody really wants more info on that. That's the January-February QEX. The other thing I just wanted to recommend, also just a quick recommendation, is one of the new ARRL publications, which is Antenna Physics, an Introduction. It's got some nice material there that that you always talk about on the TechNet. Nice introduction to antennas. A lot of the things that you have already mentioned, but it also gives a little bit of the math to go with it. So it's one of the newer ARRL publications, and it's a pretty nice book. Those are my only comments, Dick. Back to you.
GXM with a comment.
Go right ahead, Rich.
John, I have it on good authority that the Nano VNA is about to be upgraded to version 2. With a greatly expanded memory. So if you were thinking of buying it and haven't bought it yet, you might want to wait a couple of months.
Yeah, very interesting. Actually, the situation on that is that my department at SUNY Farmingdale, they got a couple, they got four of them in-house. And me and Doug Kim, one of the other hams in the department, naturally got to take it home. So I have it right here. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure if it's the new upgraded one or not. I'm pretty sure it is, because we got it about 4 weeks ago. So I think it is the new upgraded one. I haven't had too much of a chance to play with it, but I'm going to be doing some play with playing around with it with this upcoming semester. Go ahead.
Well, actually, the person who told me this might be on the net tonight, so that's all the information I know, and I don't think it's happened yet, so maybe you don't, and one way or the other, WB2GXM.
Thank you, Rich. John, many of the articles that appear in QEX are construction articles. They give you printed circuit board layout and things like that. This sounds to me like they're giving you a write-up of a commercial product called Nano VNA. And for those who are not familiar with those letters, Vector Network Analyzer is what VNA stands for. A very handy item, which is a combination of a synthesized signal generator that can move in hops in frequency increments across the band of interest, combined with a vector detector. In other words, a detector that looks at the signal strength and phase angle of the signal strength after it's been through a device on the test, like a filter or amplifier. So your VNA applies a signal to, let's say, a filter, and the signals that come through the filter get measured again by the other side of the VNA, the output connector, and It tells you amplitude and phase angle from which you can draw Smith chart and let me think now, the circular type diagram, what is it called now? Can't think of the name of it.
Polar display.
Smith chart. Polar display. And a Smith chart is a polar display. And so, Izzy, John, you can now tell us the QEX write-up, January and February, I presume, of 2020, is not a construction article. It's telling you how to, it's telling you characteristics and how to use this commercial product. Is that what's going on there, John? N2VDH, WA2VDH, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, that's right, Dick. Yeah, it's a review by Nutham. I forget his call. I don't have the magazine in front of me. I left it to a colleague. But yeah, it's a review of the Nano VNA, the one, the same one we talked about a few weeks ago. The one I have is Nano VNA-F, and I see that the release date on the blurb here in the package is release 1.1, dated 12 November 2019. So I think this is the original one, not the upgraded one, as was just mentioned, that's going to be released soon. But I did get to play with it a little bit. I put it on my R7 vertical to scan over the ham bands, and it does show it a good, nice low SWR dip on around each of the ham bands. So it is a nice little toy, but I really haven't gotten to play with it as far as putting a filter on it or anything like that. Okay.
Now, quite a few people don't get QEX and haven't seen the vector VNA of the Nano VNA. I was going to call it micro. Nano VNA. Nano means 10 to the minus 9. Micro is 10 to the minus 6. A micrometer is 10 to the minus 6 meters, and a nanometer is 10 to the minus 9 meters. Nano and micro are a prefix to some other unit, like length meaning meter, I guess it also could be even light years. But now nobody would talk about a nano light year, but you know what I mean. Give us a quick description, John, as to what does it physically look like, roughly how many dollars does it cost, and I presume it has maybe a display, or maybe the laptop becomes a display you connect it to, and I presume it's the keyboard of the laptop that allows you to give it commands. A bunch of these are my guess because I haven't seen the unit or the article. So go ahead and describe it. Take your time describing physically what it looks like, how you talk to it, and how it talks to you. And I presume it also gets powered by the USB port of your laptop, of your, if you're feeding it with a laptop, that's my guess. WA2VDH, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Okay, fine business, Dick. Okay, let's see, it's got two ports, naturally, port one, port two. At the very top, it shows a little diagram indicating what hookups you do if you want to read S11, and it shows the arrow coming out of port 1 turning back around into port 1. So if you want to read S11, you use only port 1, and then an arrow going from port 1 to port 2 if you want to do S21 or turn it around for S12. As far as its physical size, it's about 3 inches by about 5, about 3 by 5, maybe a little bit longer. It has its own screen for display, which will display a Smith chart or polar plot or a linear plot. That is, you can just plot SWR if you want to as a function of frequency. You can also do return loss and other things. As a matter of fact, just to get the chart out here, you can display SWR, you can do log magnitude, phase, delay. And it has a Smith chart plot out if you want. It has its own screen. It is a touch screen, but you don't have to hook it to a computer to get a display. Let me drop. You don't have to hook it to a computer. You can if you want to. It has a USB port where you can hook it up to a computer and get a large screen display or even take that and get a printout if you wanted to. But it will do, in color, it will do a Smith chart. It will do a linear display of SWR as a function of frequency. And that was what I was using. I hooked it up to do S11 on my R7 vertical for HF bands, and I could see it, the antenna where it would resonate around 14 and 14 and a half megs, where it would resonate around 17 megahertz for 17 meters, and then up at 15 meters. I don't have my entire length of traps up for my R7, so I did not get any response down at 40. The lower bands, but for the price, and I'm not sure what the price is. As I say, this was gotten by my department chairman, so he got four of them for a couple of people in the department to play with. So it's just sort of a loan. So I'm not too sure what the price is. I'll have to check on that, see what the economics is. Oh, let me drop. But it's very nice. It has its own power source. You can charge it through the USB, okay. But then it will operate standalone. So if you wanted to, you could climb up a tower and hook it up right to your Yagi on the tower if you wanted to, and get a reading right there. Or you can do it through the through the cable. The connectors on it are SMA connectors. But they do give you a couple of lengths of cable where you can put adapters on if you wanted to go from SMA to BNC or even UHF. So, because one of the things I was worried about was strain on the SMA connectors. So there is a semi-flexible cable that you can hook up there and then put an adapter on there if you wanted to go to a UHF connector. But all in all, it's really not bad. Back to you, Dick.
The J1 and J2 input and output connectors, and J1 can be an input and output connector if you're measuring S11. S11, by the way, is a so-called scattering parameter. That's why it's called S. And the 11 is a reverse of common sense. The first one indicates what you're using for the output, and the second one is what you're using for the input. So S11 means output, input are both on that connector in that order. Is that connector a UHF, a BNC? Oh, I think it did tell me it's an SMA. These are SMA connectors. Is that what I think you said, John? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, that's right, Dick. Both of the connectors are SMA. Connectors, and they give you a length of a cable that has two SMA connectors on it that's flexible. So if you wanted to put an adapter on it, you wouldn't put the adapter right on the device, because I would be very concerned about the strain on these smaller connectors. I put the flex cable on there and then put the adapter at the other end of that cable. So there's no strain on these SMA connectors, because I have heard of some HTs that have SMA connectors on them. The connector actually breaks off. So it's good that they give you a little some flex line, and then you can put an adapter on the other end of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, the SMA is a very high quality, very high frequency connector, which I think is good to like 20 gigahertz. It's relatively small. It's approximately 3 millimeter in diameter. It's very similar to the so-called 3 millimeter connector. And the one weakness it has is it cannot tolerate a large amount of cantilever loading. In other words, as if you had a ruler sticking out from the side of a yardstick sticking out from the flat top table, and you're putting a weight on the end of the yardstick, the part that overhangs. That's cantilever loading. You're bending it. And so an SMA connector cannot tolerate a great deal of bending moment in foot pounds or dyne inches, if you know what I mean. So by putting a piece of flexible cable there, you get rid of essentially all of the cantilever loading, and now you're only left with a linear loading, inline loading, and as long as you don't tug on it too hard, that would probably be all right. Now, if I'm using a device that's got two connectors to it, like a filter, input connector and output connector from the filter, the piece of cable they give you with an SMA connector on each end is good for one of those connectors. You'll have to make up or obtain a second connector of cable with connectors on each end that you put on the J2 port to make sure you're not cantilever loading that one. Too bad that it didn't give you two pieces of flexible cable. But with the one piece of flexible cable, you could run it directly from J1 to J2, and that's probably one of the calibration procedures for the nano VNA. Is that true, John? WA2VDH, K2RIW?
W2TTT with an idea?
W2TTT. Gordon, I think that is. Go ahead, Gordon.
Real quick, they do make, I've seen them, SMA males that have shoulders on them and that have a BNC adapter on the other end. So I used that on my THF6 for years with a BNC ducky, and that prevented that cantilever leverage from being a problem. W2TTT.
Now, are you saying that this adapter has a right-angle connector on the SMA, therefore, in theory, you in most directions, you're only twisting it, but there's still a direction where you could provide cantilever loading if you were not smart, but maybe I got the wrong picture on that one. TTT, K2RIW. By the way, do I have your name right? I'm a little bit forgetful of names.
Q5, yes, you got it right, Dick. Yes, I'm Gordon. Yeah, what I'm saying is it's a round connector, it's collinear. It's a collinear adapter. It basically is a milled connector with a center pin, an insulated center pin that goes through. That's an SMA on one side, SMA male on one side, and a BNC female on the other. They're usually gold-plated, and you'll find them at Hamfest, and actually, you can probably find them on eBay and Amazon, too, if you look carefully. But it's an SMA male to BNC female adapter, and it's round. So, you know, it provides a full shoulder all around.
Now, full shoulder, if the SMA had a wide shoulder that reached down to the front panel of the nano VNA, that would stop it from being cantilever loaded. It would only become a linear loading when you try twisting it. Although maybe what you're saying is that the BNC connector, usually you would connect it to a flexible piece of cable, and that flexible piece of cable right at this adapter removes cantilever loading. So when you set a shoulder all the way around, says the if it had a shoulder all the way around, you couldn't reach in there and tighten the nut on the SMA. So I've got a little bit of conflict here as to how this adapter removes cantilever loading. If I had this adapter screwed into the nano VNA, and then I push the adapter, the top of the adapter with my finger sideways, wouldn't I be cantilever loading the SMA connector? Over to you, Gordon. W2TTT, K2RIW.
No, it's shaped like a two-tiered birthday cake, so the bottom edge of the SMA is like a half inch or so wide, and you know it wraps over, it envelops the SMA female, and then provides a female BNC on top.
Dick?
Who is that?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention there are two pieces, each about 5 inches long, two pieces of SMA to SMA cable that come with the unit. So you can put these two pieces of cable on each of the connectors, and then put your adapter at the other end. So that should remove any strain or problems. Go ahead.
Yeah, except now you've got another piece of circuitry in the circuit. You want to minimize all the extraneous stuff.
You can calibrate that out. You can do your cal right at the end of those cables.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, you can, until it moves or flexes. But yeah, whatever. It's all good. I mean, but I was just trying to minimize the forces, and that's what I did for my THF-6. It basically wrapped over. It's an SMA male that goes right over top of the SMA female, and is broader. It doesn't have that small six-sided nut. Instead, it's got a big knurled perimeter that's a half inch or so in diameter, maybe bigger, and that's what I used.
Gordon, that adapter that you're describing, who manufactures it, and roughly how many dollars? Adapters like that tend to be a little bit pricey. Over to you, Gordon.
It was about $4 or $5, and I found them on eBay and Amazon, and at HamFest.
It sounds like a darn nice approach. Sounds like it was designed for just an application like this. Now, when you use the two pieces of flexible cable that they gave you, John, that gets rid of the cantilever loading of the SMA. But it still leaves you with a bit of a sex problem, because I am guessing the piece of 5-inch long cable with SMAs on each end, quite possibly it is male on each end, and if you were trying to use Gordon's adapter, you'd need another SMA bullet, a female to female, in order to make the sexes come out right. Although, there's a slim possibility, no, I was about to say they might have given you SMA male on one end of the cable and SMA female on the other end of the cable. If they did that, you wouldn't easily be able to use the cable as a jumper between J1 and J2 as part of a calibration procedure. So you might still have a sex problem when it comes to the adapter you want to use. Maybe you've got a way around that one. And maybe you already own some SMA bullets. They're a little bit rare. To the A2 VDH, K2LIW.
Yeah, fine business. Yes, both of the cables are male to male, the SMA male to SMA male. And they also give you a termination, a short, and a load for doing calibration there right at the end. What I have here, of course, is I have SMA female to BNC of a female, or also I have an adapter that will go from SMA, will mate with an SMA male and come out with a UHF connector. So I have a whole stash of adapters that I've accumulated over the years. Okay.
Dick, are you monitoring an email? I'll send you something in about a half hour.
Okay, I thank you, Gordon. So you're going to send me a picture of this thing. Sounds like a beauty. And what was your motivation for buying it, Gordon? Because you own a Nano VNA or some other similar piece of electronics? Back to you, Gordon.
I had a THF-6, and I broke off the antenna connector off of one of them. At one point, every member of my family had one, plus we had a spare. So, when I broke one off on my hip, I said, I got to solve this. And so I found this adapter and changed antennas, and problem solved.
Yeah, in this case, place the order, write a check, and the problem goes away. Very nice, that Nano VNA. And Antenna Physics, I think I've seen a copy of that book. I might even have a copy of it, haven't opened it for a while. And there's a lot of physics going on with an antenna. Someday I'll give you guys a little bit of a talk on the three basic kinds of antennas. I mean, there's, in my opinion, not everyone's going to agree. I think there's 5,000 kinds of antennas in the world. But they've broken down into three sections. Those that have a definite area that you see, like a parabolic dish or a feed horn, a horn antenna, the area that you see and the effective area of the antenna are very close to each other. That's one kind. The other two kinds are traveling wave and standing wave. A traveling wave would be a rhombic or a can't think of the one now that lies parallel to the ground. All of a sudden, I've forgotten the name of that one. All right.
Beverage.
That's it, Beverage. Give that man a cigar. So the Beverage antenna is a traveling wave antenna, meaning traveling wave means the signal goes in one direction on the antenna and essentially never comes back and never goes in the other direction. A standing wave antenna, which is 98% of all the antennas we use, are standing wave antennas. The signal bounces back and forth inside of the antenna when you're using it in both the receive mode and the transmit mode. Therefore, the antenna has a definite resonant frequency because there are only a given number of frequencies at which the bounces come back at just the right length. They stay in step with each other. They're coherent bounces. And that's where all the effective area of the antenna comes from, all of those bounces. Each bounce adds up a little bit of antenna area. There's one way of looking at it. And so there's a huge amount of physics of Q and bandwidth and rise time and fall time and effective capture area. There's a whole bunch of physics principles all tied together on that kind of an antenna. Alrighty, we now know an awful lot about the nano VNA, and we're about to go over to Rich, WB2GXM. What subject would you like to talk about tonight, Rich? K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the group, WB2GXM. Thank you, Dick. Actually, I am starting to teach myself how to construct balance. Very fascinated with the idea of making my own balance, which up to this weekend, I had considered kind of radio voodoo, and I was just going to go buy them. I don't need to buy them. I can build them. So, quick question. Is there any reason why I cannot use standard run-of-the-mill lamp cord, or zip cord as they call it, to wind a balance?
The answer is almost no problem. That is to say, zip cord is two leads very close to each other with some rubber holding them that way. And I believe the spacing and diameters comes out to be around a 70 or 90 ohm impedance of zip cord. That's the good news. The rubber of the zip cord, though, is not a high quality radio kind of rubber. A high quality radio rubber would be nylon is quite good. Teflon would be excellent, excellent, excellent. But nobody makes a to my knowledge, makes Teflon zip cord. So depending on how tight the balun is wound, if there's enough air space in between the twin lead turns, or the zip cord turns, then you wouldn't be exciting a great deal of the rubber from turn to turn. But you're still using, in many cases, the zip cord in a differential manner. In other words, at any one position, let me drop. At any one position on the zip cord, you've got a right-hand signal going forward and a left-hand signal coming back on those two wires of the zip cord. So therefore, there is a significant amount of E-field across the rubber. So lost tangent of the rubber is the only thing I worry about, which is going to be very frequency sensitive. At 80 meters, I think the zip cord is perfect. At 1296, I think the quality of the rubber and its loss tangent could give you some grief. Grief meaning that your balancing device is now going to have a mysterious kind of insertion loss, that it's really a heating loss if you're running at 1296. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. So for the majority of frequencies you're likely to use it, I think the zip cord is going to work like a charm. And by the way, you can make homebrew zip cord. Take two leads of your favorite kind of wire with some kind of quality insulation, hopefully, and simply twist them. Twisted wire makes an extremely... Let me drop. Twisted wire, as cheap and as quick and dirty as it looks, is an extremely well-shielded transmission line. It's in many cases higher in quality than the 300 ohm transmission line that we used to use on television sets in the old days. So making homebrew zip cord, the fact that it's twisted is an advantage in most cases, so that the homebrew zip code, meaning just any two pairs of wire, they may be red and the black, so you can keep track of which one's got which connection from end to end. You can make homebrew zip code by twisting them together along the length. Over to you, Rich, WB2GXM, K2RIW. Now, what frequencies do you intend to use these balloons on?
Dick, I would be using the ballon from 80 meters through 10 meters. Would not be using it above 10 meters. So you're telling me first I would take the two wires and twist them, and then I would treat them as one single twisted pair and use that to wind the ballon. That's what I'm understanding.
That's one of a number of ways of using it. Two wires twisted together, and you feed them in parallel. In other words, you connect them at the input end, you connect the two together, and at the output end, you connect the two together. You've now just made a physically more complicated version of one single wire. You think there's two wires there. Your eye sees two wires, but there's really one when you use it that way. However, with the twisted pair, just like with zip cord, you can now feed it in a differential manner. There are a number of kinds of ballons where you have two wires side by side used out of phase with each other in the balloning device. So the twisted pair will serve that function if you're not connecting the ends together. And the zip cord, so you decided to use zip cord. It sounds to me like you're going to put the two wires together and use the zip cord as one wire. There's no great advantage of doing that other than the fact that you're using something you happen to have. But the zip cord could be used differentially, and there are some exotic ballons. There is a beautiful article in the Microwave Theory and Techniques Journal. I think it's way back in 1990 or so. The article is entitled Ruthruff is the author's name. Ruthruff, some balloning devices. He's got about 18 kinds of ballons in there, and a number of them use the equivalent of zip cord. So if you Google those words, Ruthruff and some balloning devices in Microwave Theory and Techniques Journal, quite possibly you'll find a website that'll allow you to see this beautiful article. WB2GXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Apology for the misunderstanding. I was intending to use the zip cord in a differential manner. One side would be for the input, and one side would be for the output, as it were. And what I was, the first article I was reading was about creating a 4-to-1 ballon, where the one side would be, you know, for the 50 ohm, and the other side would be for the 300 ohm. And so I understand twisting two wires together and then winding the ballon using that would be the same as using the zip cord in a differential manner.
You've got it. And in the case of the zip cord, you would carefully wind it such that it's not twisted. It's just people tend to do that. And the leads lying side by side throughout all the turns, they believe has something magic going to it. If you took zip cord and twisted the zip cord, which now electrically makes something very similar to the two wires twisted together, in almost all cases, that will act the same in a balloning device. The RF energy doesn't have to have it look symmetrical with the two wires untwisted, if you know what I mean, for most of those ballons. So ballons are fun devices. They give you some great advantages. Some of them are not easy to explain. You set a 4-to-1 ballon, starting with 50 ohms at one side. 50 ohms and 4-to-1 would be 200. And 200 is close to 300. That wouldn't give much of a standing wave ratio. If you did want 300, you'd be looking for 6-to-1. Believe it or not, there's ways of making 6-to-1, probably 8-to-1, 4-to-1. I think there's a way of making 3-to-1. So by fancy techniques, ballons can give you simultaneous balloning and impedance matching, all wrapped together in one structure. And when you start adding a ferrite iron to the core, you get other capabilities as long as the iron can go high enough in frequency. 80 meters to 10 meters, you're down at the DC bands where my worry about the lost tangent of the rubber of the twin lead of the zip cord is probably not worth worrying about. WD2GXM, K2IW. You got it, then. Rich.
Hello?
I'm just starting to learn about the balance, so I'll start with that information and continue from there. I love learning about new stuff. K2RIW, WP2GXM.
And if you're running at the quarter watt level or below, you can use a 50 ohm resistor as a 50 ohm dummy load, 100 ohm resistor or 300 ohm resistor, and so on. A fixed resistor, Allen Bradley resistor, with the two leads coming out of the end. Because the resistor is so short compared to the wavelength involved, it becomes a ideal dummy load. In many cases, does not require shielding, and it will not radiate because it is so physically so small. There's not enough antenna length to it, so to speak. So by putting, once you wind these balance, once you create these balance, and you want to test what is the input impedance and output impedance and ratios, you can put dummy loads, which are Allen Bradley resistors, in the right places. And now with your nano VNA on the input, with, say for instance, you've got a 4-to-1 balance, and you put a 200 ohm Allen Bradley resistor as the output end of your balance, and your input end, you expect it with 4-to-1 to be a 50 ohm load, and how close it's to 50 ohms, your Victor VNA will tell you right away, and you're simultaneously measuring the balance performance electronically, as well as the combination of the balun connected with very short leads to the 200 ohm resistor in that example. So you can do an amazing amount of testing where if you've got surface mount resistors, they automatically are pretty small. You could use those as dummy loads, but Allen Bradley resistors will do the job very nicely. Carbon internal type Allen Bradley resistors. By the way, let me drop this. People have done a very small amount of tuning of an Allen Bradley resistor. Like, if you wanted to put a 52 ohm load on something, and you've got a high quality 50 ohm Allen Bradley resistor, by taking the sharp edge of a jeweler's file, you file a notch in the across the length crosswise. You file a notch into the 52 ohm resistor. I got it backwards, 50 ohm resistor, and you can, as you slowly make that notch, it'll go up to 51, 52, 53 ohms. You're removing a little bit of the plastic on the outside of the Allen Bradley. You're eventually digging into the powder structure inside, and you can do some fine tuning of its resistance with a file. Not many people do that, and you can only do it in one direction, as you can tell. You can raise the resistance, you can't lower it by that means. So, because the resistors themselves are so inexpensive, if you damage one in the process, it's not much of a loss. WB2GXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good information. Very good. I do have the AORL Balun book, and I see there's a Balun book being marketed by CQ Magazine. I may invest in that one also. K2RIW, WB2GXM.
Yeah, from time to time I've heard people buy those and they seem to be fairly pleased with them. Okay, we've run out of people who signed into the list. And by the way, last week or the week before, there was somebody who was going to build a chunk of electronics, an inverter running from a battery to feed his refrigerator, in order to make the refrigerator more efficient, because he felt the refrigerator was the biggest electrical use device in his house. And what happens in some cases is the refrigerator runs nearly 24 hours a day because the exchange heating coils in the bottom, the so-called condenser coil, has a fan blowing air over it, but there's no clear design filter anywhere in that system. So eventually that coil in the base of the refrigerator, underneath the wheels, under the bottom of the refrigerator, builds up dust bunnies and cat hair and dog hair, and therefore not as much air flows through there. Therefore, the coils run hot. When the coils run hot, the refrigerator compressor runs less efficient and tends to run much longer periods of time. So although it's no easy job to open up the refrigerator door all the way, remove that grill that's on the bottom of the refrigerator up front and look in there with a flashlight, and there's usually some cardboard in the back of the refrigerator held on with sheet metal screws, and you open up that cardboard and now you can see both sides of the condenser coils and their fins and the fan that's blowing air over them down there, and you get a chance with the right kind of vacuum cleaner tools to vacuum out the dust bunnies and the vacuum out the dust bunnies and cat hair and dog hair so that now air can flow more freely over those coils. They run cooler, the refrigerator runs much more efficiently, will run for much shorter periods of time, it'll consume a lot less electricity and last a lot longer. In the old days, the condenser coils used to be a great big round barrel-like structure sitting on top of the old refrigerators. That had some nice cooling and no problem there. For a while, they used to put the condenser coil was really a 20-foot long piece of copper tubing that was zigzagged across the back of the refrigerator. The whole back surface of the refrigerator was the heat radiating structure, the condenser coil. And that because it had so much area and didn't have a fan, you didn't have to worry about a little bit of dust getting on it. So that didn't need cleaning as long as the refrigerator wasn't slapped completely flat against the wall it was against, as long as a little bit of an airspace, that worked like a charm. But styling-wise, and people wanted to not worry about putting that gap in there, many refrigerator manufacturers went over to the idea of putting the coil in the bottom. And for the first year or two, that worked pretty well, until the coil starts clogging with dust bunnies, in which case you start running a refrigerator longer and longer. So very few people know that, and therefore they end up buying another refrigerator when it fails prematurely because of the dust bunnies in the bottom. I wonder how many of you guys have ever heard about that cleaning procedure that can drastically increase the efficiency and life of your household refrigerator. Anybody with any comments on this? K2LIW on the TechNet.
That was me too also, Dick, WGXM.
Yeah, so did you know about those coils in the bottom and the fact that it's fed by a fan blowing air over those coils, and because there's a continuous number of cubic feet per minute of air going over the coils, it's just for a matter of time before they collect dust bunnies and cat hair. So did you know about that cleaning requirement down there? Because I am guessing the owner's manual probably does not mention that. WB2GXM, K2RIW.
Well, that's a very logical thing to bring up, and that's something I have totally overlooked. And I should take a very good look underneath the refrigerator and clean it up if necessary. But I'll tell you something, Dick, this refrigerator is so old, it might actually have its coils on the back. I would have to take a look around and find out. K2RIW, WB2GXM.
WS2N.
Paul recognized. If it's got the coil out the back, that, in my opinion, even though it may be old, is a very high-quality refrigerator. Hang on to that one. You might have to replace the rubber gasket around the perimeter of the door. I've had to do that on a old refrigerator once, so that air wasn't running in there and building up ice on the ice cube tray. WS2N, have you ever cleaned the dust bunnies out of the bottom of your refrigerator, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And there's different ways to do it. You take the thing, like you said, apart, and you go in there, they actually make it like a little brush you can play around with. So one day I got a little lazy, and I said, this has got to be a quicker way. So I took an old blanket and put it around the bottom of the front and the side. And I happen to have an electric leaf blower. No, don't laugh. But I took this thing and I took it, near the back, and I gave it a blast, and stuff still pretty much got, all over the kitchen, but I contained it, most of it with a blanket. But, if you want to do a quick job, there's some spots you're going to miss, but it's a real quickie. Back to you, Dick.
Comment?
Yeah, person who said comment, get you in a second. You could have used the air blasting tool on a compressor. You used your leaf blower, very crafty. And when it comes back to you, Paul, I'm going to want to know how much dust did you find in there? Maybe quite a bit. A person who said comment, go right ahead. You just start off with your call letters and name, sir. K2RIW.
Yeah, this is WA2VDH. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the refrigerator. I guess I have an older refrigerator. It does have the coils on the back. But one thing I do want to do this summer, most people's refrigerators sits in a little nook in the kitchen. And in my case, that nook doesn't let too much air circulate behind the back of it. I do feel a little warm air coming up, so there is some circulation, but I would like to add a little little fans in the back there just to blow some air over those coils, the condensing coils, to maybe just increase its efficiency a little bit, because it does sit into a little nook that's like a little cutout for the refrigerator in the kitchen. Oh, go ahead.
And that cutout probably reasonably tightly seals the sides. Hopefully air can run under the refrigerator and get to the back of those coils. And then on the top of the refrigerator, is there a cabinet above the refrigerator which is kind of close in so that even the top is blocked off air-wise? Over to you on that one, John.
Yeah, it's pretty tight. It's open on the top. It's not open on the bottom. It is open on the sides where air can get around there, but I was just thinking of adding a little fan, put it behind it, just to keep air moving over those coils. Hopefully it would give it a better efficiency.
Comment, KC1SAM. KC1SAM, go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, KC1SAM, regarding Paul's electric leaf blower, that works wonderful to blow out the dryer vent hose, which is very difficult to clean out, so hook the leaf blower to that, and all that stuff is in your yard when you're all done. By the way, the audio on the Kelvin is awful tonight. Luckily, I can hear Glen Ocean. Thanks for picking me up.
Yeah, I noticed that the audio... I'm looking at the audio right now out of Glen Oaks, out of Selden. My goodness. It depends on which of the voting inputs. My signal is super noisy. Your signal, you're probably going directly into Selden, and therefore you come out pretty good sounding out of the Selden repeater. Back to you for a comment on that one, Sam. KC1SAM, K2RIW.
KC1SAM, I am going into Selden, but the audio coming out is awful. I might be able to go into Glen Oaks. It's coming in pretty good tonight. But I can hear Glen Oaks really well, and the audio on that is perfect. So I'm basically listening to you on that. And I figured I'd transmit it to Selden since he could hear me a little bit better. Back to you.
Yeah, when you transmit into Selden, you come out of Selden, 375, beautiful sounding. So that's a particular voter input, so to speak. When I go into 2585, that comes out of Selden, very noisy sounding, just barely understandable. Loud enough on audio, but a lot of noise in there. So which voting input is what's going on here? So the linking to those voting inputs, my signal going into whichever input is going into in Glen Oaks, comes out with a reasonable sound of... not too much noise in the background. Oh well. So the system I think is being worked on. Okay. Cool refrigerators. And it's hard to believe that the refrigerator really is a heat pump. It's taking cold air from the ice cube tray, so to speak, cooling it a little bit further. The Freon is cooling it a little bit further. I should say cool. It's heating it. There's a cooling-heating combination going on in the refrigeration process. So the condenser coil, you want it to be a little bit hot and cooled as much as possible in order to make the refrigerator efficient. As the condenser coil runs hotter and hotter, the refrigerator is pumping its heat higher and higher uphill, has to pump harder, draws more current, runs longer, and is less efficient. Anybody else, any further questions or comments for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW and the TechNet.
KD2NVB with another refrigerator comment question.
It sounded like Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo. Correct me on that and tell me your name and then proceed. Go right ahead.
Yes, you got it right, Dick. It's Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo. My name is Bob. I've come on here occasionally. Yeah, I'm just commenting on my refrigerator. Unfortunately, you have to go all around to the back to get to where you would clean it out. And the way it's nestled in the corner, it'd be very difficult for me to move the entire refrigerator about 3.5 feet up. So I'm wondering if I could find, I don't know if you would, anyone would know this, some kind of attach it to a vacuum cleaner that could kind of be like an L shape and go around a corner and I could maybe get in there. Anyway, just throwing that out, I'm probably not the only one that has a refrigerator like that in a situation like that. Back to you, Dick.
Bob, are you trying to clean the coils that are across the back surface of the refrigerator, that kind of a refrigerator, not the kind that's got the coils in the base? Is that what you're saying? Over to you.
No, this is a new refrigerator. My refrigerator that had coils on the back died a year and a half ago, and I got this refrigerator. It's on the bottom, but there's no grill on the front or anything. I have to move the entire refrigerator out of the corner and get into the back, or find some kind of wacky vacuum cleaner attachment that could bend around corners and do it blindly. So those are my options. So I guess that's just what it is. So yeah, that's what I have.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture mentally if I had to design an adapter that went around the corner and blindly allowed you to, let's see now, it's multiple right angle turns. First turn to get around from the front of the refrigerator to the back, and then another turn to get into the back underneath to get to the coils. I'm pretty sure Paul was telling us that they make a larger version of a pipe cleaner like thing, which really is a long piece of twisted wire, which has got bristles coming out of the side of it, and you can poke it down the coils from the front in order to knock the dust down to the floor and hopefully vacuum it up. But for most of these cleaning procedures, I think you're going to be required to wheel the refrigerator out from its cubby hole, out from the wall, so that you have human access to the back of it in order to do a thorough cleaning job. The way Paul described his packing with pillows and hitting it from the rear, most likely, with his snow blower or leaf blower, and blowing it out the front. Wow, that must have put a lot of dust in various places in the kitchen. But at least he cleaned out the dust. I'm going to pass it over to Paul to give us more information. How did you know that your refrigerator needed dust cleaning? And what gave you the idea to do this? It's an extremely enthusiastic way to do it, but a very thorough way of doing it. And these very long bristle brushes that the people who do oil burner service will use, I'm guessing there's a miniature version of that, which would, if you go to an oil burner part supply like Sid Harvey, they send you a whole bunch of these thin, long brushes for oil burner service cleaning, and I think they would do the job of cleaning out the dust of the fins underneath your refrigerator. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, those long brushes would work. And, well, yeah, like I said, I took an old blanket, threw it around the front of it. It's still, you know, a lot of an escape. But, you know, I've done it many times over the years. You take the front apart, you take the back apart, you know, clean it out the best you can and all. But what happens is, you know, you realize you got this electric blower, leaf blower sitting in the garage, and you know the light bulb goes off, you know, and then you know that's how you either get successful or you wind up with a lot of problems. So it actually works. I mean, you could, you know, some of these vacuum cleaners that people have were like my dry vac.